This is Seattle's Morning News, and we're going to talk about ghost guns now. And the scary thing about ghost guns is that, in fact, they're very real. They just sort of have this invisibility cloak in that you can legally own one, and it doesn't have to have a serial number because you have made it yourself. And Jeremy White, who is a graphics editor with the New York Times, put out a video on this because you actually ordered the kit and made one yourself. Was it difficult?
It wasn't that difficult. I am somewhat handy with tools. I think if you're used to building small projects, doing home improvement things around the house, it would be pretty straightforward for anyone to build one of these.
Now, did you are these sold as kits?
You can buy them as kits. You can buy them as individual parts or as kits that contain everything that you would need to complete the project.
And there's no background check, I assume. This is not a face-to-face transaction. It just comes, you just do it over the internet?
Yes, I was sitting at my desk at work, ordered it over the internet. And the reason there is no background check is because these aren't legally guns.
Yeah.
They're parts. And at a certain point during that construction process, it becomes a gun. The part that the ATF really looks at and evaluates to see if it is how complete it is. Mm-hmm. And the lower receiver is what makes a gun legally. So it houses a lot of the internal parts that are required to actually fire a bullet out of the barrel. So if you have something that isn't really a completed receiver, whether you're printing something and you're starting from scratch or whether you're doing it the way that I ended up doing it, which was to take this polymer receiver that had extra polymer on it mm-hmm. and remove the polymer, then that became a lower receiver.
Okay, so what made your receiver legal was that it was in sort of a rough form. It could not be used to make a gun as is. You had to operate on it.
Yes, that's correct. In some cases, I had to drill holes. In other places on the receiver, I needed to go and remove extra parts, extra bits of polymer that were just sort of left over. There was a lot of sanding and filing and just kind of smoothing some of it down.
Right. So they could have sent you, not legally, but they could have sent you a ready-to-go receiver, but in order to make this legal, they leave extra plastic on, which you are required to file or drill away. And that is what makes it legal to sell these things over the internet without requiring any kind of serial number.
Correct.
Now, are there a substantial number of these out in the wild?
It's tough to tell. There's no real data on this. The only data that we can actually look at is how many of these are being seized by police forces and ATF agents in the U.S. So because these are coming from private sellers and there's no registration process and the companies that sell these don't have to be licensed firearm dealers, there's no data there to keep track of. It's like buying something off Amazon at that point.
Yeah. So if one of these were to be used in some kind of crime and left at the scene, it couldn't be traced to anybody.
Correct. It would be very difficult to find out where this came from. In fact, so I live in New York City. I can't legally bring back this finished firearm back to the city. So, you know, initially it was a kit, wasn't really a gun. But once I completed that project, I couldn't bring it back to New York. So I returned it to a police station in Virginia, and they had a difficult time finding any identifying marks or numbers or anything like that on this, what was a Glock 19, because it was just stamped with some model numbers and things like that. There was no serial number. In the U.S., it's always been legal to make your own gun.
Right.
And if you're making it for personal use, that's perfectly legal. However, what ends up happening is these are being made and then they're being sold, or they're making their way into crime scenes.
Right. And they're even more valuable because they have no history and no serial number. So what did it cost you for the kit?
Well, I had bought the kit during something called Glocktober, which is a sale during the month of October. I paid $399 for the Glock 19. And a new Glock 19 from the factory is around $500.
But yours had the advantage of not having a serial number. So do you have any idea what that would have been worth on the black market?
From what I understand, they're being sold for about twice as much as what you could buy them for.
Yeah. So that's an occupation for somebody. That's a full-time business for somebody. Just making these kits and selling them on the black market, you could make a pretty decent, I mean, there seems to be a very strong economic incentive to do this, which would mean all the laws, I mean, if this really caught on, became a cottage industry, all the laws we pass are unenforceable, just unenforceable.
Yeah, it makes it difficult. Without knowing who is acquiring these, you know, there's no background check at all. There's no check to see if someone is a domestic abuser, has a criminal past with several felonies. There's no age check. There's no citizenship check. There's nothing. So anyone with an internet connection and either a credit card or in some cases Bitcoin can acquire one of these. It's really tough to tell how popular these are, but one problem that we had along the way with this ghost gun that we built was finding a place to fire the pistol. And it wasn't because it was a homemade gun. It was because mostly it was, you know, the New York Times coming in and talking about this issue. There was no benefit for some of these gun ranges just to have us come in and do this on their property. But several conversations I had along the way with some of these employees at these gun ranges, I asked them, is this unusual? Is it just because we have something that we've made ourselves? And the answer was consistently no. This is not unusual. People are bringing these in all the time.
So it sounds like the cat's out of the bag.
Oh, the cat's out of the bag.
Yeah.
Yes.
So did you come away from the story, I don't know, feeling more or less safe?
Well, that's tough. I mean, for me, I think that I'm a big fan of the First Amendment, and, you know, I think the Second Amendment is also very important. I think that if someone wants to make their own gun for personal use, I think that should remain legal. It always has been. I don't see why it shouldn't be. However, these kits make it a little too easy, and it makes it so easy that someone can build several of these in a short amount of time. It should be a little harder if you want to build your own gun. So, on one hand, I understand the appeal of these because after building it myself, you know, quite frankly, it was fun. It was like any other small project where you're working with tools,
sure,
you have to be
sure.
Precise, you know, you're following the directions, and it's a good way to spend some time, you know, in the garage. However, for me, access is a real problem with these types of guns because it's just a little too easy to get your hands on them. Mostly anonymously. Even if you go to a gun show, you're talking to a human being, right? It's a person-to-person interaction. But here, you can be completely anonymous.
Jeremy White is graphics editor with the New York Times and built his own polymer-based Glock. You're not considering a freelance gig, are you?
I'm not going to quit my day job, no.
No, okay. Jeremy, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington, an evergreen playground blessed by an unusual variety of natural attractions.
And here is resident historian Felix Bonnell. Barnes & Noble closing down. You got to get all over that. We still have the comic store at the Pike Place Market, though, don't we?
I was in the Barnes & Noble before Christmas, and it was kind of sad. It felt kind of empty, and kind of the wind was kind of whistling through the aisles there, so no surprise about that.
Well, that's tomorrow's crusade. For now, we're up in the Sandpoint neighborhood where the National Archives, sort of a nondescript building, but it's been there for 60 years, might be about to leave town.
Yeah, and it's a big surprise to pretty much everyone involved. This goes back to 2016. There's some legislation passed called FASTA, Federal Asset Sale and Transfer. They charged the government with finding high-value assets they could sell quickly to make some coin. And they came up with a list of properties. Those were released in late October of last year. They were made public at the end of November. On that list is, first of all, that big facility down in Auburn, the 127-acre GSA campus. That's on the list. But also on the list is 10 acres in Sandpoint neighborhood where the archives have been for 60 years. And it came as a surprise to the employees of that facility a couple days ago. It's come as a huge surprise to historians and other people who work in these kinds of materials. That's all the federal records for Washington, Idaho, Oregon, and Alaska, going back to the 1840s.
Wow.
Huge asset, used by the public all the time. There's a research room. People can go in there and do research on genealogy or whatever you're looking into that related to court cases and all sorts of stuff. Now, turns out there's no public process. And on January 26th, the Office of Management and Budget will either accept all these recommendations to close all these places and sell them or reject them. And they'll probably accept them. And what I found out this morning was that Representative Pramila Jayapal's office knew about this on October 29th of last year. They were briefed by the staff of this public agency called Public Buildings Reform Board. And it's an expedited process. There's no input.
So they couldn't do anything about it? Or?
Well, they weren't told to keep a lid on it. And they Jayapal's office this morning, just a moment or two ago, told me that they thought there would be more public outreach from this organization, the Public Buildings Reform Board, that somebody would sort of reach out to the public to let them know this was a possibility. If you look at the list of other properties, like that place in Auburn, there's some old Nike missile bases on the East Coast, there's some other big acreages in California. This one stands out because it actually has a constituency, and it's actually being used, and there's people who are upset by it.
Yeah.
Those other properties all seem to fit the profile of places where there's, you know, it's a big building and one person's working there and the public doesn't go there. This one's a little unusual. And I think the pressure is because it's Seattle and our real estate market is, you know, crazy.
Sure.
And 10 acres in that great neighborhood, not too far from Sandpoint. It's part of the old Navy base, the federal property there. And it could have been, I don't know who owned the property before the feds did back in the 1940s. But it seems like it's just been this expedited process means that the public is totally out of the loop. And now people are really mad about that because what they'll do, they'll take those records and move them to Southern California and Missouri.
And these are Washington State records.
Yeah, going back to the 1840s.
Northwest
records in a place that people use and have been using since the early 1960s.
Well, a good excuse for a trip to Los Angeles if you're...
Or what about Kansas City?
Well, that'd be bad.
Anyway, so the bigger issue is like there's just been no public process. And that's a big piece of property in a beautiful, important city like Seattle for there to be no public
input. So what are you going to do about it?
Well, I mean, all you can do right now is get the word out. And I've noticed on social media, since we did a little story about this on Wednesday morning, just kind of a breaking news story, and people have been responding on social media, sending letters to Jayapal and to Senators Murray and Cantwell to try and get input at this point. It seems crazy that OMB would reject everything. They can't just pick out one property and say, we aren't going to sell that one. But if the process can be slowed down or delayed, it kind of misses the point of the legislation of the expedited process of making money off federal property. So it's hard to see any kind of a win coming from this unless the whole thing is rejected and you start from scratch and actually involve the public in the decision or take this one off the list because it's different from all those other properties that are being underutilized.
Sounds like you're pretty upset.
You know, it's just I don't like when the public's kept in the dark about something that they have a stake in. That's not right. That's not what this government's about, Dave.
Yep, you got it. So keep us apprised.
Oh, I definitely will. Hopefully I'll have more. I'll be back later this morning with an update.
All right. Felix Bunnell, as you just heard, he's going to be back later this morning. First I heard about
breaking history. Do you have a breaking history sounder?
We will now.
Okay. This is Seattle's Morning News. It's a pleasure to welcome back for the 2020 tax season Don DeSantis, a principal with Clifton Larson Allen, also known somewhat less formally as the Tax Whisperer. And Don, you were telling me about audit rates, IRS audit rates, and it turns out that the poorer you are, the greater your chance of being audited. What did the statistics show?
There's an interesting statistic, and this comes directly from the IRS last year. And the important point is that the overall audit rate has dropped dramatically from 2010 to 2019, from well over 1% to about 0.45% chance of being audited.
0.45?
0.45%.
Yikes.
What you're citing is that the highest audit rate in the country is in Humphrey County, Mississippi, where the average income is $24,000, the audit rate is 4.8%. And that's because there's so many returns filed there with the earned income tax credit. But it's ironic that one of the poorest counties in the U.S. has the highest audit rate.
Well, I mean, if the idea is to make sure everybody pays their fair share and to bring in some serious money to the federal treasury, why are you auditing people who are so poor that they can file for the earned income tax credit?
Well, because historically, and this is unfortunate, there's been a lot of fraud involved with the income tax credit. So the IRS has made that a priority. But it's an interesting question there. You know, are we talking the big dollars or the small dollars?
Okay, then. So moving away from statistics for a particular geographical area, let's talk about income levels. Which income levels are likely to have the fewest audits?
Oh, the lowest audit rate. I think if you're around somewhere 50,000 to 75,000, the audit rate is about 0.5. And as you go up, you know, like income of 200,000, a million, 5 million, the audit rates do jump quite a bit. They go up to 6.67% for people between 1 and 5 million and 11.5% for people between 5 and 10 million. Those were 2010 numbers. Now, they're still higher than anything else. But for example, if you make between 5 and 10 million, the audit rate dropped from 2010 of 11.5% to 6.66%. So that's a 64% decline almost.
Okay, so the millionaires still get more scrutiny than the middle class does. But what you're saying is that the audit rate for them is also dropping.
Oh, yes. It's dropped even more than for, say, middle-class taxpayers. They're still audited more often, but the IRS's audit rate has gone down.
Okay. Now, the federal government is now running annual deficits of $1 trillion. They need the money. So why are audit rates dropping?
Well, I think it's happening because Congress over the last 10 years has decided to cut funding for the IRS. It's down almost $1 billion. And then when you factor in inflation, it could even be more than that. Furthermore, the number of employees at the IRS from 2010 till now has dropped 22%. And the number of revenue agents who go out and do these audits has dropped about 30%.
So how much money are they actually leaving on the table in terms of tax money?
The GAO said that what they call the tax gap, in other words, the income that should be reported versus what is being reported, they estimate to be $458 billion a year.
Wow.
So there's a sizable tax gap. Now, multiply that by 25% for some average, and it's over $100 billion.
Well, I mean, it's not huge compared to the federal budget, but it's also not insignificant either. Is anybody talking about doing something about that?
Actually, not a lot. I mean, it gets discussed, but it doesn't seem to be getting a lot of traction. Now, you would be saying, why is Congress cutting the IRS budget? And they've actually reversed it, and they're starting to increase it slightly, but it's still below, I think, 2010 levels. Congress has said, well, we think you guys need to be more efficient. You know, this is the age of technology, and you need to use technology to, manage the tax collection system. And so that's, on that rationale, they've been cutting the budget, which has then caused an exodus of people from the IRS. There's been a lot of retirements and people leaving.
Is the tax compliance rate going up or down?
It's going down. It's about 82%, and maybe 10 or 20 years ago, GAO estimated it to be 85 or 86%.
To me, the problem is this perception that a lot of people, a substantial number of people are getting away with something, then more honest people are going to say, why should I be so careful? If I'm being paid in cash, why be a sucker and report it if nobody else is?
Well, I think that is a serious concern. That's why the Treasury Department is very concerned about this. One other thing I wanted to say is part of their budgetary restrictions, not only have they had a decline in people, but they're closing a lot of their offices. And so it's not as easy to walk in at the IRS anymore. For example, the Bellevue, Washington office was closed about a year ago. And so what the IRS is now saying is, you've got questions, you've got issues, we've got a website, go to the web.
Well, there it is. I guess the good news is your chances of being audited are pretty darn small. On the other hand, this is one of the reasons that the government is running such horrible deficits. Don DeSantis, our tax whisperer from Clifton Larson Allen. Thank you, Don.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
I love that musical.
One more day.
Yeah.
Tom Tangney joins us now with a review of Les Miserables, but this is not the one that most of us recognize.
That's right, not at all. This is Les Miserables without Valjean, or Javert, or Fantine. And in case you're a fan of the musicals like I am, Dave, of Les Miserables, it's definitely without songs, too. This 2020 film is indeed using the title of Victor Hugo's classic, and one can argue it embodies the spirit of the 19th century novel, but it has an entirely new plot, a new set of characters, and a new century, the 21st. Now, the movie is still set in Paris, or more accurately, the suburbs of Paris. And quite cleverly, in fact, it's even set in the same neighborhood that Hugo both wrote Les Miserables and placed some of the book's actions. If you're really into Les Mis, the Thénardiers, Dave, they're in, is in the place that a new movie is
set. Master of the House?
Master of the House, you bet. So today, Montfermeil is a poverty-stricken area with a mostly African and Arab immigrant population. Not surprisingly, tensions run high between the cops and the citizenry especially, but also between civilian factions, rival gangs, the Muslim Brotherhood, gypsies, or Roma, etc. Now, into this volatile mix, the movie plops a police officer named Stefan, who's new to the area. He's teamed with a couple of veteran cops, one a power-tripping hothead named Chris, the other a more reasonable-seeming African officer named Guad. As the two veterans make their rounds, Stefan becomes more and more disturbed at how they treat the people. They, in turn, dismiss him as a rube who doesn't understand the way things work in the projects.
The plot gets underway when a lion cub goes missing from a circus traveling nearby, and the carnies threaten to riot if the cub is not returned. Something unexpected happens in the follow-through, and the resulting standoff between all the various factions and the cops creates a metaphorical tinderbox. Inspired by the riots in the suburbs of Paris over a decade ago, Les Miserables not only does a good job of creating a real sense of life on the ground in Montfermeil, it also does its best to humanize all parties involved. Without condoning police brutality, the film bears witness to the complexity of police work. And without excusing criminal violence, it acknowledges the justifiable rage felt in the immigrant communities. It's no surprise to find out that first-time director Lajali is himself an immigrant from Mali, grew up in the very same projects in Montfermeil, and even served time behind bars. Now, this film may not have cribbed its story from Victor Hugo, but it does incorporate a crucial few lines from his novel. There are no such things as bad plants or bad men. There are only bad cultivators. An apt summation of Les Miserables, the film. Already the jury prize winner at last year's Cannes Film Festival, Les Miserables is also a nominee for Best International Film at this year's Academy Awards.
Well, you're a frequent visitor to Paris.
Yes.
Is this like the Chicago South Side?
Yes. Well, that's what it feels like. Now, I have to admit, I've never spent any time in this particular city. I might not town. I might go out there now just because I didn't realize this has a Victor Hugo connection. But it is, you can tell when you take train in from the airport into central Paris, into like the touristy part of Paris, you go by projects yes. upon projects upon projects, and that's where this is set. So it's not tourist area. I don't even know how yeah. well
we think we have graffiti with that train ride. Is yes. an amazing experience.
It's eye opening, yeah. isn't it? And it makes a lot of sense. And what I like about it is he got a lot of access, to the ground in that city because he comes from that city and knows it really well. It's an eye opener.
How many tangs for Les Miserables, the new version?
3 tangs out of 4, Dave.
There we go. Thank you, Tom.
Sure.
Time now for your daily dose of kindness. It's brought to you by Mike Novak and List with Novak.com. Let's meet a small group of friends who started a life-changing support group back in high school. They took that effort, launched in a garage in 2001 nationwide. We get the story from CBS's Vladimir Dutier.
A group of high school juniors rallied around their friend Rob Matar as he was going through chemotherapy for testicular cancer.
I remember coming home from baseball practice. There were about maybe 15 friends here, and Rob's mom had reached out to us beforehand just to say that Rob was starting to lose his hair, and he was feeling really self-conscious about it.
So the group came up with a plan to shave their heads to match their friend.
So people were like, are you doing it? And the next guy's like, yes, I'm in. And then they do it. And then the next person's like, do me next. And it just built this momentum.
And they took that momentum and started the club at their high school, with more than 200 people showing up to the first Student Movement Against Cancer, or SMAC meeting. The club held events and provided emotional support to students affected by cancer. By senior year, they had raised more than $100,000 through fundraisers.
It made me feel great. That immediate support helped me get through that stage.
But amidst Rob's diagnosis, his father was battling widespread cancer.
I actually had chemotherapy sitting next to my father.
Chemotherapy sitting next to your dad?
Yeah.
What was that like?
It makes you feel better in a way about getting chemotherapy because you're with your father and you have that natural bond of, well, this is terrible, but we actually laughed about it.
While Rob recovered, his father did not. He died Rob's freshman year of college.
My thoughts drifted to your mom, who would have watched her husband and then her son dealing with these insurmountable challenges. Have you spoken to her about what that was like to have the two men in her life dealing with cancer at the very same time?
I don't know a stronger woman in the history of the world. She was so brave. She put on her game face at a time when she probably, really just wanted to probably go in a room and hide.
Rob found new meaning through his work with SMAC.
In the aftermath of all that, thank God I was okay. So I had that moment where I was able to use SMAC to get through a difficult time. So you want to start SMAC at your school.
Now, nearly 20 years later,
we started a board of directors based on that original crew of people, the people who were a part of it from the beginning. and started to dream again about what it could be.
Rene Ramos leads the first New York chapter of SMAC in his Bronx high school.
This program means a lot to me. My grandfather died because of cancer. We actually have a few students who lost their parents because of cancer. And, you know, being there to help them, support them, it just feels amazing.
The group of friends eventually ended up back where it all began.
One, two, three.
But this time, with a new generation of future SMAC leaders.
There are now 18 SMAC chapters across the Northeast. The organization has raised more than $2 million.
That's incredible.
Sports Insider from 710 ESPN Seattle. Here she is, Stacey Ross from Tom, Jake, and Stacey. Before we get to the playoff games this weekend, last time we discussed Odell Beckham Jr., he was handing out cash to LSU players. He's an LSU alum. After they won their championship. There's some speculation that was just fake money. But then what happened later on in the locker room, Stacey?
Later on in the locker room, a New Orleans police officer who I believe was working just under direction of the Superdome where they were playing the game was telling celebrating LSU players to put out their cigars because there was a no smoking policy. And there's a video captured of this event, by the way. It looks like in the video, he's telling them to put out their cigars, but he's also maybe questioning what's in the bottle. One player is holding like a juice bottle. So I think he's wondering what's in that, probably assuming it's alcohol or questioning if it's alcohol. So in the video that's circulating online, you can see the officer do that. And he's kind of talking to this player. And behind him, Odell Beckham Jr. reaches out and slaps him on the butt. The officer turns around looking pretty mad. And to be honest, Odell Beckham Jr. looks kind of mad. And then it just kind of nothing happens from there. So what happens is yesterday, the New Orleans police issued an arrest warrant for Odell Beckham Jr. on a complaint of simple battery. Initially, I think they wanted to charge him with sexual battery just because he did slap him on the butt. So It technically falls under that.
Right.
And then I think a judge or the person issuing the warrant said, no, it's not that severe. You're going with simple battery. So the Browns have issued a statement saying they're working with authorities, and that's the latest update we have from that.
Huh. So an unwelcome slap on the butt is against the law. But is the feeling here that the officer was kind of being a spoilsport? This is a pretty special thing, right? So if a kid wants to light up a cigar and drink in the locker room, as long as he doesn't drive drunk, then you sort of look the other way, don't you?
You should not be hitting an officer, but I think the understanding, if you read any news article from New Orleans, even like NOLA or whatever, I think everyone in the state of Louisiana is thinking, man, you're ruining these kids' celebration. Just, you know, come on. So I think there are torn opinions.
Well, was the slap on the butt designed to sting, or was it the usual locker room slap on the butt?
Okay, so when this story was first explained to me, I hadn't seen the video yet. And so they said pat on the butt. And I'm thinking, you guys know, how often in athletics do we see that? I mean, come on. Like, I'm not worried about someone giving someone a pat on the butt in a football locker room. But it does look like he actually slaps him. So it would certainly be something where it would be inappropriate. If a friend or teammate did that, I would be like, what are you doing? Go, you need to calm down. But it's tough because it is in an environment where you're thinking, first of all, we don't know if Odell Beckham Jr. is like drunk or something in this moment. And secondly, it is tough because you're thinking, man, just let these kids have fun. Right. So,
well, I know I should take a stand on this, but I'm going to have to wait until more evidence comes in. So let's move on.
That's how I feel.
Let's move on to the final playoffs before the Super Bowl. And the question is who to root for and can you root for San Francisco? Can you be a Seattle fan? I mean, it's tempting because that would mean that Richard Sherman, I mean, if they go on to win the Super Bowl, he'd win a Super Bowl with two different teams, right?
Yep.
Has that been done before?
It has. It would be a really cool legacy for him to have. I just don't think I'm convincing any Seahawks fans listening to root for the 49ers. What I will say is I was talking to James earlier on the phone and said, I kind of wish that the AFC championship was the Super Bowl because that's the storyline I'm far more interested in. You've got Kansas City, which is the favorite. They're playing at home. Young quarterback in Patrick Mahomes, who is electric. He's so fun to watch. Mm-hmm. He's arguably the best quarterback in the NFL, right up there with Lamar Jackson and Russell Wilson. You've got other great players there. Andy Reid, who's just a brilliant play caller. And then on the other side of things, you've got the Tennessee Titans, who have been at least 4-point underdogs throughout the playoffs, mm-hmm. have beaten the Patriots and the number one seeded Baltimore Ravens to get here, which is unreal. And more than that, and I think this might resonate with Seahawks fans, they're doing it in a way that analytics would tell you you can't win.
Yeah.
They're doing it by running the football and really running the football. Derrick Henry has 180 yards in his last three games, at least rushing, which is, I can't even put into words how uncanny that kind of production is. But everything would tell you it's not effective and it's not the right way to win the game in 2019. But he's just proving them wrong. And it's a fascinating conversation.
Yeah. So they're sort of the Cinderella team then?
Absolutely. 1,000%. You've got Ryan Tannehill there too. I don't know if you guys are familiar with him, but he's someone who was a first round pick to originally succeed with the Dolphins, be their franchise quarterback, had this kind of fall from grace over there because it didn't work out, considered a bust, was traded for practically nothing to the Titans to be their backup, and then replaced their starter and has since helped lead them to the Super Bowl.
It's a good story. Well,
it is a great story.
I'm going to wait for more evidence on that one too before taking a stand.
That's fair.
Thank you, Stacey.
That's fair.
This is Seattle's Morning News. What do you do when your young child acts up in public? Let's ask Allie with licensed mental health counselor Allie Sokolow, sponsored by Pro Club, the region's premier center for health and wellness. I guess first question is, what's an appropriate age for the first outing with your young child?
Oh, I would say that people should get out with their kids as soon as possible. I think a lot of people feel very housebound after they have babies. And so being able to get out and get comfortable having your child out is a great thing to do.
Well, actually, we took our granddaughter to a tea room at the age of about 1 year and kept her distracted and things went pretty well. But then there are times you'll be out in public and you'll see a young child just lose it. She'll throw a complete tantrum. So what do you do?
First of all, I would say that depending on the age, you want to be able to sort of gauge how long they can stay out in the world and not have a meltdown. Like, you know your child the best. And so, you know, don't plan on taking your child to the mall for 3 hours and think that they're going to be okay, because that's not going to happen. So making sure that they're fed, that you're not going at a time where they're usually napping.
I find it's also good to have an escape route. I remember we were hard up for a babysitter, but we had very expensive opera tickets. And our first daughter was, I believe she was 6 months old. So we put her in the little snuggly and we got seats up in the third tier near the aisle. And she lasted through 2.5 acts. So I thought,
wow,
that was pretty good. And then my wife made the quick escape for the big finale where the fat lady sang, back when they had fat ladies. So, I mean, having a plan B is always good. So, all right. So the meltdown.
I totally agree.
The meltdown has happened. People are looking at you.
Yep.
What do you do?
The example that we always see is at the grocery store, and usually it's right when you walk by the candy aisle and the kid has lost their mind on the ground, kicking and screaming, and the parents are horrified. If they're yelling and screaming, what you don't want to do is engage in the behavior. And so I think this is the hardest thing for parents, because they get really embarrassed really fast and they just want their kid to stop. So they try to start bargaining with their child, and that will never work.
No bargaining then.
No bargaining. No bargaining. There's a lot of like threatening in there. Like, if you don't stop now, you're not going to get blah, blah, blah after this. And it's like the kid has no rational thought process at that time. And so don't try to threaten or bargain with them.
Mm. And you can't spank them, right?
No. Well, not in this day and age.
No.
Actually, that's the other thing, is that what people would used to do is they would spank or they would walk away. Mm-hmm. And now those things are highly frowned upon and people get pretty upset and Child Protective Service gets involved and all the things. And so you want to stay with your child, but you don't want to engage in the behavior. And I will tell parents, it's going to feel horrible and you're going to feel so embarrassed, and your gut instinct is going to try to talk the kid out of throwing the fit, and it's just going to make it worse.
Yeah, I think it happened once to me at the QFC. We took her shopping and she wanted something and I wasn't going to buy it, and she got defiant, and I very quietly picked her up and just walked out.
That's exactly
right. Just cancel the shopping trip.
And that's the thing. It's okay to just leave your cart and go. What you want to do is get them into the car, into their car seat, and let them scream it out or whatever they need to do. But bribing them is letting them know that they can do it again and training them to say, hey, if you throw a big enough fit, you're going to get what you want because I'm so desperate to make you stop.
By the way, why do perfectly cute, behaved kids turn into monsters once they're in a grocery store?
There is so, I mean, think about a grocery store. Like for a lot of us, we don't like grocery shopping. It's very overwhelming. Same thing for kids, except they're little tiny humans. And so it's so much stimulus. It's bright lights. It's pretty colors. It's like all these things they've never seen before. And they want it all. And they want to touch all the things. And that gets overwhelming, especially when they're told they can't touch anything. But I think we could do a public service announcement. Like, if you see somebody having a meltdown in a grocery store, don't give their parents the evil eye, because it's
there
just
but for
nice.
The grace of God go you.
That's right. Yeah, but it's hard, and you have to take kids out, and the more kids go out and the more they're exposed to things, the less temper tantrums you'll see.
Ali Sokolow, licensed mental health counselor. Ali, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.